In the studio this morning, I have Priyesh Tiwari. Priyesh is a medical doctor and physician who was born in India and has been in New Zealand less than a year. And he works with the University of Auckland, doing a PhD with them in health informatics. So kia ora and namaste.
Namaste, kia ora, Tim. How are you?
Very well, very well. Priyesh, we see Western allopathic medicine and a growing alternative complementary and traditional medicine group as well. Where do you see healthcare going as we enter the second decade of the 21st century?
Okay, so should I give a brief answer? Healthcare is going towards health. That's a brief answer. But to elaborate on it, most of the healthcare, as we call it today, is disease-focused. We are talking about modern medicine is all about, when I went to medical school, we all studied was about disease and how diseases happen, how diseases prevented, how diseases were treated. But it occurred to me quite late that we never studied health other than just the definition of health given by World Health Organization, which says it's a state of physical, mental, social, and spiritual well-being. So nobody taught me what mental well-being was, what emotional well-being, what social well-being, or what spiritual well-being was. So my natural inclination was to learn more about these things because health is primary, and when health is gone, diseases fill the vacuum. So that's the understanding I evolved to. And as a result, I looked for answers in multiple healthcare systems, studying them in great details and trying them out, practicing them, and seeing what they actually lead to. And it occurred to me is that most of the traditional, or which we call as alternative today, those systems of medicines were more looking at keeping people healthy. I mean, we all know about Chinese system of medicine or Indian system of medicine because the doctors were paid or were given some benefits if the community was healthy. So sickness was seen as a failure of the doctor. Here, sickness is seen as a success of the doctor. So it's two different paradigms. And what has happened is that alternative healthcare in today, modern times, it's the, so to say, collective consciousness is so strong about playing the role of a hero and a savior that focus has shifted more towards treating diseases rather than promoting health. And we all know that the maladies that our healthcare system faces today is because we are not preventing enough diseases, we are not keeping people healthy. If we keep people healthy, keep them out of the hospital, we bring the cost down. And of course, we cannot cure everything, but at least we can help people to live health at their best. So as my understanding goes, is modern healthcare today, even at the New Zealand Health Strategy, if you look at, it's mainly focusing towards how can we keep people healthier, how can we keep people at home, and how can we ensure that people live or follow principles of health and well-being in their life. That's the focus of modern healthcare. That's where it's going in the 21st century. And I'm not saying it's the New Zealand Health Strategy saying. And not only New Zealand, it's all many other countries whose healthcare system is rapidly failing is because people are overly relying on the system, not relying on themselves. So focus is on that. Even alternative healthcare systems would eventually fall back to those principles. And I meet very, very interesting and very wise people and who have the deep understanding of a traditional system of medicine and who have taught me that those are the systems which taught you about how various external influences or weather or diet or exercise or thought processes or people around you, how they influence your state of health. And when from a perfect state, let's say if ideally there would be some perfect state of health, and how we slowly begin to shift from that perfect state of health. And disease is a much later outcome. We know about heart disease. We know about cancers. They happen years after years and years of mutations or atherosclerotic processes happening within your body, and it can be predicted long in advance. So we see a trend that people from health are moving towards a disease, and then a diagnosis takes place. Unfortunately, we cannot diagnose people before they fall sick. There is no measure of health. There is measure of disease. Of course, thousands of scans and lab tests and everything could measure disease, but how do you measure health? Hardly any. But in some of the systems of medicine, there are measures of health. And I remember you mentioned my training in India. In Sanskrit, we define health as swastha. Swastha means swa, means self. Stha means established. So established in your own true nature is being healthy. Now you can take it at any level. You can take it at your physical genetic level, or you can take it highest spiritual level. being established in your own self is the definition of health. And whenever you are not established in your own true nature, then you create the vacuum for a pathology or an aberration to appear. So I see those very strong trends appearing, is that people are going to take care of themselves, and all healthcare people are going to be helping them to take care of themselves better. And people are going to make choices whether I want to choose allopathic system of medicine or I want to choose Ayurvedic system of medicine or any other system of medicine, depending on what they feel they need, because they are going to be more and more informed and more aware. And we talk about being more and more informed. The commonest source of information which has opened up the whole box of knowledge is internet and technology. And first thing when people do, all the research is showing, is that when people want to know about health, first thing they go is Google it or look at the internet for those answers. And I'm being more and more convinced that technology is going to play more and more important role in coming times in sharing this information and empowering people and helping them make better choices. So that's why my PhD is also in health informatics, because I see that that's a platform where the two streams or multiple streams of thought can merge together and be available to a user at his disposal, how he wants to use it. That's one trend I see.
Because the natural is coming back. We in the Western world, of course, we're suffering so much from eating processed foods mm-hmm. and drinks mm-hmm. to a degree now that, of course, we're totally overweight and suffering from diabetes, etc. And yet all we have to do is throttle back a bit and go and start eating more naturally and exercising more. But it's what we take into our body.
True, true. It does happen, but you need to look at it from multiple angles. Because suppose today I want to eat healthy, but where is the healthy food? Can I afford it? If I need to exercise, does my infrastructure allow me to do that? Or my time constraints allow me to do that? Or my family burdens allow me to do that? So we have to look at more. We don't have to blame people for making wrong choices. It's the whole collective. All of us together in this system have to think. The food producers have to be more consciously food producing. They should start using healthier ways of growing food. Organic things. I mean, we know about organic agriculture there. And China, for example, is supplying 25% of organic supplies to the rest of the world. And they are the most technologically advanced nation. So we, in New Zealand, I see a huge opportunity. We are close to nature. Nature has been so kind on us. I mean, the day I've arrived here and I've said, so blessed is this land, so fertile. Mm. Nature is so, I mean, grass is always green. It never dries up. So it doesn't happen in India, I must accept. And it's all new. It's just, the soil has not yet lost its fertility. So there's a huge scope of taking care of the soil, taking care of the plants, the herbs, the trees, the animals, the flowers. I mean, you have to live on your strengths and you have to leverage on your strengths. And once we start doing that, people will have more healthy options available to them than they have the other ones. That's level one that we can interfere. Secondly, we can make them available easily to people. So I always think of promoting health at many times as making choices available to people at their disposal. For example, when they pick up the phone to order a pizza or a hamburger, is there a healthy food line? Can they call Subway or can they call any other healthy food line? Because sandwiches are boring after a while, so Subway you can't call for anything. But can there be other food choices? So it's not that they're not available, but they, over a period of time, what I see is more and more corporates are going to take keen interest into it. Now, McDonald's, I've seen that the flyer they have tips about health. Not necessarily the food changes, but at least the education is there. So I think that there is a trend. There is a trend towards helping people live healthier lives. And also is how we create our social systems, our educational system. I always believe that health, if you want to practice health, it starts in schools, not in hospitals. Because disease starts in hospitals, health starts in schools. So can we train our youth towards, let's say, healthy choices? There's a huge epidemic of childhood obesity going on. A good friend of mine who's the health minister of one of the countries now, he did his PhD in childhood obesity. And he went two steps ahead. He not only inculcated the subject of education into school healthcare, school educational system as a subject, but also went on and produced organic or healthy yogurts and fruit choices and, I mean, other products which were using natural, say, preservative agents or natural foodstuff, and all the calories and nutrients and multivitamins were all integrated into it. So we need more and more entrepreneurs that way who could push such forms of choices or who could make available such forms of choices to people. So, yes, there is a lot of pollution. There is a lot of artificialness in our diets. There's a lot of inactivity and sedentary lifestyles picking up. But I think if we don't proactively engage with people at an early age and educate families and children and societies, doctors, to me, is in true sense of terms are preachers, because that's what the word means. And they would definitely play that role, and many of them are playing that role.
So we've got to have consciousness, got to be a conscious choice right from the fact of conscious conception, bringing your child into the world. What are we going to feed our child? How are we going to love our child into being? And then, of course, when we look at particularly, say, the Indian way of life, they've seen the body as a temple.
Yes.
And so it's how we inculcate this understanding into our children, so that we take in fresh, clear air. We have to, we make sure that our water or what we drink is going to be so good for us, the food, and of course not have, should we say, toxic relationships.
Right.
Did you want to add anything to the fact that we as a human being, what we need to do from a personal point of view?
Well, your statement brings the image of a temple to my mind. In that image, what I see when we go to temples, first thing you do is clean yourself. Take your shoes off, wash your hands. In many temples, you have to change your clothes as well. And when you go inside, that's a whole arena of peace and quietness and love and harmony. You just go there and you feel emotionally touched in one of some of the temples that I've been, without even being theistic or without being believer or something. I've been a very objective thought processes I have carried, but I've just been very sensitive to how I feel when I walk into a temple. And I ask myself, why do I feel this way? It was just when I walk into a railway station, I feel a totally jarred and stressed out and chaotic without participating in it. So it's the environment that is created around. And how is that environment created? And I ask myself, and I see a lot of symbolism happening in temples. They use the purest form of water to wash the deity or the image or the idol, whatever they keep. They use scented natural herbal pastes and natural ingredients to give a bath to it. And then they put new clothes and then they feed the deity. I mean, it's a stone deity. It's not going to eat, but I'm just watching the symbology here. They feed the freshest of foods which have been cooked by hand by the priest with a sense of devotion, that it is an offering going to the Lord. And then they sing the glory of it with drums and music and dance around him. And once they celebrate with this, celebration is over, then everybody who's attending the celebration gets this prasadam, as we call it, or the offering is being shared with everybody else. So there's huge symbology of sharing. So if we treat our body as a temple, aren't we obliged to nicely take care of it with the purest form of water? And then the hand cook with love, the food that is going into the deity which lives in this temple, which is you, yourself, your higher self, or whatever you want to call it. And then the best part of it is when you share the best that you've got in it. So giving, loving, and sharing is inculcated into being who you are, because we are not isolated beings. We are part of the whole, let's say, universe. So how do I give my outputs? Share as a prasadam, not as a selfish sense of giving because I want my name on the charity book, but just the joy of giving. And that's what makes people happy. And I see a lot of happiness index in some of the countries which are not very rich, and unhappiness growing in countries which are very rich and affluent. And I read the statistics that about 14% of children in this country have contemplated suicide at some point in time. I said, wow, what's happening? Probably one thing comes to me, there may be many things, I don't know, but one thing comes to me is that are we teaching our next generation to give, is to selflessly serve, or to give back? So instead of demanding, Dad, I want this, and do this for me, and you don't take care of me, instead of, what can I do for you? What can I give out? And once we start giving out, I mean, everybody wants love. The chase behind the members of opposite sect wanting love. But wanting love doesn't make you happy. It's giving love which makes you happy. So that shift. And in those countries where social boundaries are less, stiff upper lip is not there, and people are more humble and open and do social living, and they share their spaces with each other, and one part of it is a lot of people sharing that same space, a lot of population. But one thing happens is that you selflessly begin to give and in those cultures. So probably that makes people happier. I don't know.
Well, I do know that with a young child, say a three-year-old, or mm-hmm. you ask them to help somewhere.
Yes.
And they go and they'll do all these things and they'll bring things to you.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And you praise them and they feel so good.
Mm.
And so it's there, isn't it? And so how can we do this when we've got 6.8 billion human beings on the planet?
Mm.
And to see that service is an important component.
Yeah.
It's like it's an in-breath and an out-breath.
Mm-hmm.
So it's give and take.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How do we find this reciprocity?
Right. Well, so many things to say and do. But I'll just give you my example as to how I was motivated as a doctor to give. I used to work in a big hospital in India. And this big hospital was getting bigger and forging some international collaborations and building health cities. But we were only dealing with people who could afford healthcare services and who were willing to pay, and international patients and all rich and well-to-do. So it was a big five-star hospital kind of a thing, I would say. But I realized that more than 70% of India's population lives in villages, and more than half of those people earn less than a dollar a day. And how can they afford this big, huge five-star hospital? They can't, and I see every day. They are forced to go to a public health facility, which is difficult to understand from this point of view, because public health facilities in India doesn't work. It is in shambles. Not that they're not trying, they're trying their best, but it's in shambles. And people are relegated to subhuman forms of a treatment because that's what their country can afford and that's what they can afford. So I said, no, something has to be done in that direction. So I just walked into a tribal community, and I started working with some tribal people. And I said, as a doctor, I can help only a few, 10 or 15 or 20, if I'm physically doing it. So what I started doing is we got a team together, and in the same hospital. And the good thing was that these people were also considering corporate social responsibility, which is a sense of giving. So I took that opportunity and funding from that side and chose that, how do I give? And we said, no, one person or a few doctors cannot give because doctors have their own life. They can't go and live in villages. I can, but no, everybody else can't. So this is because what time many times happens, it becomes a personal model. It doesn't become an impersonal model. So I wanted to make an impersonal model. So we started selecting people from the villages themselves, a little bit educated, a little bit smart, usually ladies, because in male-dominated societies, empowering women is the way to transform health in those poor communities. So we chose women. And we trained those women to become health workers. And not only simple health workers, we trained them with the help of technology. We gave them simple mobile phones. And in those mobile phones, we coded the entire clinical process so that we don't have to train them clinically. But for example, if you go to a villager goes to that lady with a problem, says, I've got pain in abdomen, she looks at her booklet and says, pain in abdomen means 41. So she enters 41 in this mobile phone. And there is a code which asks, since how many days? They'll ask 7, so how many days? It's in local language. The entire program was in local language. So local language, she would read how many days, she would ask how many days and say 7. So she'd press 7. And does it go up or down? The whole range of questions will follow automatically. And we call it a clinical decision support system. But it is a support system designed for a health worker where she can elicit symptoms in a logical way. And then it prompts, and we gave them simple kits with homeopathic and Ayurvedic medicines in them. And those bottles had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 numbers written on it so that they don't have to know and remember the names of medicines. They can just read the numbers. So decision support tree would either, this mobile phone would guide them either to give them 4 pills from bottle number 3 or call the doctor immediately or wait to call her tomorrow for a follow-up. So once this decision she could make, she would call up the doctor in the city, and the entire data in the form of electronic health record would go and sit in doctor's computer, and the doctor would see. And he would see that patient of 45 years presenting with pain in abdomen, radiating downwards, with loose motions, with a tinge of blood. Oh, immediately he would say, this is a diagnosis I'm seeing. So he can call back to the device, talk to the person, and type prescriptions on his computer, land up on the mobile device as a prescription and could be given to the person. And a copy would go to the pharmacy, which is about 20 kilometers away. And if this person chooses to pay for this medicine, say she pays the health worker, the information goes to the pharmacy that the money has been paid. Within 24 hours, the local teacher who's traveling between the two cities collects those medicines, gives it to the village. So within 24 hours, the prescription medicines were also made available to these village people. So I could see how local empowerment, local entrepreneurship, technology assistance, and developing a system around it could make it very impersonal. Now, it doesn't have to be me. It could be a doctor at any corner of the world sitting with a computer and helping those people out. And once we started doing it, we realized that many people needed to be hospitalized, and this hospital care was out of their pockets. So we floated something called as a micro-insurance program, where they just saved 10 cents a day, which they could save. And if this 10 cents a day could be saved, the entire community could get benefit for basic hospitalization, drugs, diagnostics, everything for free. So it is not that it was very difficult to do, but if you have the will, it is possible to do. And we bent the rules, and we use the same principles of Six Sigma, because Six Sigma is 100% efficiency, no waste. And if you're offering an insurance for $8 for a family of four to have a free healthcare for 1 year, you better be Six Sigma. Otherwise, you're going to go into losses. So we employed management principles. We took partnership with pharmaceutical companies, herbal producers, and many other partnerships we explored, which all pooled their resources because we could obtain medicines which was one-tenth of the generic medicine cost. Generic is already cheaper than branded, and this was cheaper than the generic because they came and said that this is a huge population, because 70% of 1 billion people. Can you imagine the size of business? So I was very inspired by two people. One was Muhammad Yunus, who got the Nobel Peace Prize a couple of years back for designing microfinance, which helped poor people come out of their poverty using their own resources. And he also empowered women. And this is how we learned from that microfinance model.
He was in Bangladesh?
He was in Bangladesh, yes. And in fact, there was some discussion between Grameen and our effort to some collaborations through Harvard University. But I mean, coming back to what was possible here is that healthcare became affordable at the cost they could. And most importantly, we trained these health workers to educate people, to educate children, to at least conduct a class, at least teach them how to wash hands before eating, how to cook healthy. And we partnered with agricultural agencies who could teach them how to grow organic so that their dependence on this pesticides and chemicals would go down. And that also created financial value for them so that they became richer, and so that they became richer, they could be better health. They could have better health access or whatever it is. So it is a feeding cycle. I mean, that nature, living naturally, being healthy and being supported. But all healthcare agencies or enlightened people or educated people need to do is transfer that knowledge to that context. And this is what we can do, at least, is transfer the knowledge to a different context and to help them. So when you mentioned is that how can we give? I mean, there are many ways of giving. It doesn't have to be giving money. It's giving your knowledge.
This is so inspiring, because you can replicate these models throughout the whole country and then at the spillover into Bangladesh, Pakistan, or wherever.
Yes.
So this is a fantastic model for going forward, isn't it?
Yep, and the project that we are working with is we're looking at from 5 villages to 5 districts, and 5 districts to 5 states, and 5 states to 5 countries in 5 years. It's a formula of 5.
Excellent. This is fantastic. I'm speaking with Priyesh Tiwari on medicine and health and how we can heal the human race, really, isn't it?
Yep.
Because we are all born into this world. And we all want the same thing. We want the enjoyment of life and of family and love and being able to grow and reach our potential. So where do you think things could go now as a result of you telling and sharing with this audience of what's happening in India? I mean, we've got a very positive future to look forward to.
Yes, we do. But we always have a choice. Because future is not defined. It is today. What we do today defines what comes tomorrow. So we have today in our hands. And I would like to appeal to all your audience is that what good they can do today and now as they are listening to me is what will define everybody's future. My future is in your hands. So be inspired and do something today.
Random acts of kindness.
Random acts of kindness, yes. Sometimes I wake up in the morning and today decide that I'm going to practice one act of giving today. And that act could be as simple as not yelling at my daughter when she spills water on my dress.
I have great communications with people in supermarkets and shops, the people standing at the counter, taking your money, etc.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you can actually have very good communications
yes.
and inspire them. And, of course, they will then share their mirth or their goodwill with the
yep.
next person coming in.
Yep.
And
yep.
everyone's an extension, or we're all an extension of everything else.
Exactly. We are all connected to each other. And one thing when we could realize is that I'm not a standalone unit. I'm part of the whole universe, and universe is full of love and peace and joy. This is what my understanding is. Yours may be different, but my understanding is the minute that you let go, that I am an island and disconnected, all unhappiness goes away, and there is a spontaneous flow of joy and happiness begins to happen. And definition of health starts from there. I mean, you begin to heal yourself. And mostly, what happens is that we feel that we are abandoned, we are isolated, and nobody loves me, and nobody takes care of me. And I've seen that very common underlying sentiment in modern and developed societies, is that people tend to be emotionally less open than the intellectually very bright, and they can talk about emotions from their head, but not from their heart. So I think we need to make that small journey between head to heart, and then our mouth and tongue and throat comes in between, which is communication. So more we express ourselves, and by giving and sharing, then more we connect to our hearts. And there could be many ways, because the minute you begin to connect yourself to your heart and to the larger universe around you, you become closer to whatever your definition of God is.
Because India, in many ways, is the home of yoga,
mm-hmm.
which they say to yoke or to connect or union.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been to India on numerous occasions and experienced the profundity of the thought and the knowledge and the wisdom and that goes back.
Mm-hmm.
So with our personal yoga of every day, it is... Mm-hmm. Again, it's how we breathe into the world and how we dissolve into it
mm-hmm.
and then breathe back in. And again, we're just energy fields, aren't we?
Yep. Yoga recognizes that. And yoga says, I've studied yoga for some time as a part of my studies, and I understood that yoga says is that once you become still and focused, then you begin to see many things that you were not seeing before, within yourself and outside of yourself. We're so distracted by this jarring outside world is that our minds hardly get an opportunity to focus and see. The options are so many and distractions are so many that we hardly stop and see. So when we talk about being disconnected from our own hearts, a part of it, I'll translate a little bit into a scientific lingo, that people have seen that if your brain waves are very fast and moving, it's called as the beta wave activity. You're very, very distracted, and you're very extroverted, and you're very into outside. And as the brain waves begin to slow down into alpha and other rhythms, slower rhythms, you become more focused, more pointed, more concentrated, and you begin to appreciate more what is happening within you or outside you. People become more self-aware. And there was one small experiment that we were doing with a technique which is called as yoga nidra, which is a technique of yogic relaxation. And we hooked people's brains into an instrument called as BEAM, which is brain electrical activity mapping, which is basically a whole range of hundreds of electrodes on your scalp measuring what's the chatter going on inside. I mean, don't listen to the chatter, but you can just see the waves. So, and you project it onto a screen, and what that screen does is converts these signals into colors. So if your brain wave at a particular point is very fast, it'll show red colors. If it is slow, it'll show blue colors. So when you hook up people, like we are doing something extroverted, you'll see all red and orange around in the whole brain. And when people would be dreaming, that's again orange and red and other things. When people say that, how do you relax? Oh, I go to parties. So we hooked up somebody who was partying and he was all orange and red. So I said, where's the relaxation in here? Whereas when people begin to drift into sleep, the colors from red and orange began to turn into greens and yellows and blues, hues of blues, and all of a sudden the dream comes and again the colors go brighter. So I realized that people, even they are sleeping, they're not deeply sleeping. We feel that we are sleeping, but we wake up tired instead of waking up all refreshed. So what happened? Probably we didn't sleep deep enough. And when you take them through a relaxation technique, where you activate various areas of the brain in a systematic way, using a set of commands and allow them to relax and synchronize with each other, you begin to see that the brain waves begin to slow down. And you see all blues and greens and deep blues within a period of 15 to 20 minutes. And person is not asleep, but he's still showing theta and delta waves. Normally, medical scientists would say that theta and delta would mean person is asleep, but the person is wide awake, but he's deeply, profoundly relaxed. And in that profoundly relaxed state, he's very aware of the thinking process. What's going on within me? And sometimes you can give inspiring food to the mind in that receptive state, which builds person's positive emotions, repertoire of positive emotions. And that's how we slowly begin to transform people. Because we unknowingly get programmed by the fears and distractions of outside world. News is what? All fears and excitement. Somebody died, all these images of fear and horror and damages. What do we see around us? All competition and aggression and, you know, me the winner. So that's what we are being programmed towards. But can we go back and can we revert back and can we create moments of stillness and silence within ourselves? And that is what yoga starts with. How to create these moments of stillness and silence so that you can listen to yourself and be a better human being. And there is an opportunity of programming ourselves with positive thoughts, because the cognitive behavior therapy or the modern psychotherapy teaches us that emotions are under our control. The way we think, we can control our own emotions. Not controlling, but at least guiding those emotions, because emotion is a far stronger force than thought. But we can slowly begin to program and get. And yoga teaches us that how we can use this faculty to gain mastery over emotions and mastery over instincts and drives. And not mastery meaning, how do you master hunger? By eating a balanced diet. I mean, as simple as that. I'm not talking about being levitating or things like that. Mastery is a very simple and very subtle technique. So, being a balanced and simple life, and that is what yoga teaches us. And the ultimate outcome is samadhi, and samadhi means, dhi means the buddhi, means the intellect, and sam means balanced. So samadhi literally means a balanced mind, a balanced intellect, which is a broad depth and width of its understanding of life. That is what samadhi is all about. So it just happens by living life consciously.
Wonderful stuff, because in my simplicity, I like to see myself as, say, like I get a glass, pure clear glass, mm-hmm. and I put some water in it and I put a bit of dirt and mm-hmm. I stir it all up mm-hmm. and it becomes just dirty.
Right.
Then I leave it out and after a while it becomes still, and finally all the granules and the dirt and the water mm-hmm. drop to the bottom.
Yep.
And all the rest of the water is clear and light can pass through it.
Correct.
So if we are in many ways an empty vessel, mm-hmm. if we can still our mind and not get caught up in the media and what's happening in the outside world, then we can be clear in our being.
Yes.
And that's when the next step of mm-hmm. our evolution takes yeah. place.
And that's why we say clarity of thought, clarity of perception. So wisdom is what? Clarity. So, and most intelligent and most wise people, including Einstein, had very clear thinking process. And if you read books of very intelligent people, they have a very clear stream of thought that they follow. So clarity is, of course, very correct. But the thing is that our glasses are kept in a moving car. And even if we keep them still, the car is still moving. So we live in a society, an outside world, which is moving at a fast pace. And just leaving the glass would not be enough. We need to pull some shock-absorbing cushions under it. And what are those shock-absorbing cushions that we need to build so that we become still? And it's very easy to preach to become still, but to actually give people tools to become still is a difficult thing. And those shock absorbers, what we need is in terms of good nutrition. Because if you are nutritionally deficient or twisted nutrition or obesity or whatever you want to call it, that is a platform where your brain is not in the most steady state. How many of us eat breakfast on the run? Almost all of us who are going to work. Where do we sit down and look at what we are eating and how we are eating? And can we really meditate as well as we are eating? Can we really enjoy the taste and the flavors that we are eating? We hardly do that. So one bottom line is that having good nutritional state to have your brain being able to do. Second thing is having a good rested brain. So having a good sleep, that's a very strong thing. We could have good sleep. So, I mean, for example, Ayurveda says the three signs of health. Three signs of health is that you feel hungry on time, you sleep well, means you wake up refreshed, and you go to the loo on an everyday basis. As simple as that.
Yes. Yes, because when we listen to the news and get this outside world stuff coming at us, we see that we are in the greatest transition.
Yeah.
We are sort of, in Indian terms, Kali Yuga,
yes,
where the shadow gets its chance to dance,
yes,
or when matter becomes its most densest.
Yes.
This is the stage we're going through, nearly to get through to the other side.
Right.
So as a humanity, the health and well-being of us,
yeah,
the great change can happen right now, as you say, in mm-hmm. sort of choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll just first complete what I was saying earlier. Is to have that harmonious balance on the platform. One is a nutrition, I said, and second is well-rested body, because rest is very important. And during rest, your brain secretes some of the chemicals which are repairing and healing. One of them is melatonin, and there are many more which repair and heal. And third thing we could do is physical activity or exercise on a regular basis, because the muscles and the blood circulation and the metabolism gets regulated. So these are the three things which will cushion you. And that's why yoga says about asanas, about exercise, the yamas and the niyamas and the pranayamas. And then you can start meditating. So build the platform. Coming back to the question of Kali Yuga, you said that, yeah, it's true that matter is its densest. But it prompts me to think is that when we were all in spirit state, we were all angels, right? And when we came into this life and this body, the matter became the densest. And why did we come into this life? And I'm going to get a little philosophical here, if you allow me to. So the reason is to learn some lessons and to do things that we promised ourselves that we would do. And that's why we chose, or we made a choice, to descend onto human planet as human beings and learn and contribute, both at the same time. And when the matter is densest, the learning is packed. So this is Kali Yuga, is the fastest learning time for us, because more challenges life throws at you, faster you evolve and learn. I mean, it's very easy for me to go and lie down on this is a beautiful country. I can go to a beach and live in a resort and be happy and angelic and not worry about it and ascend. So, but will that leave me happy at the end of it? Will I be contented and satisfied that I came here? Maybe I will, or maybe not. Probably my karmas or my destiny would call me to do something different. So as long as I understand what my destiny calls me to do, Kali Yuga is the fastest way to learn, I would say. And the tougher life is for you, the stronger the lessons and the learning opportunities for you. So don't complain that life is tough. It's teaching you. It's just you're not learning it.
Yes.
So teachers sometimes get toughest with these students who are kindest sometimes to teach some lessons. And that's what I believe that life does to us. And I've always seen challenges as learning opportunities. And now it's always occurred to me that whenever there is a problem in which I'm going to do, or I was talking about this rural project and many other projects that I was involved in, and there were many challenges. But at each challenge, I would look back and see, what is it that I have not learned? And what is it that this challenge is trying to teach me? And the minute I focused from problems and complaining to learning, immediately there was a solution. And I moved to the next challenge. So I think that's what life is all about. It's just throwing us challenges and we learn. And the minute you crack it, you move on to the next level.
It's character building.
Yes, it is. It is. It is. It is.
This is all wonderful, inspiring, uplifting information that you're sharing with us. And I'm just so happy that you're here to be able to do this. How do you feel that we can... I mean, I've always wanted to see the human race rise from this huge survival struggle with a lot of... We've gone through horror for thousands of years and heartbreak. Any ideas on how we as a humanity can awaken to the possibilities of shifting to a higher level of being?
Well, whatever I say here is already been said. Because there have been hundreds, many, many wise people. I mean, you look Deepak Chopra's books you read, Dear Nondinish's work you read, or Andrew Weil's work you read. I mean, doctors who have become preachers or a little bit inclined towards the spiritual side because they saw that health is holistic and multidimensional and they were being representing themselves as true doctors in their own definitions. And at the same time, many masters have come and taught us. Jesus has come and taught so many things. And so many wise traditions in this world who have taught us that how this ascension can happen. And I have been deeply influenced by at least three schools of thought. One was a Vedic school of thought, and the yogic school of thought, and the tantric school of thought. And these are the three schools of thought that have influenced my thought process because they have already thought what I had didn't think. But I never occurred to me, and somebody had already looked at me and I said, this was my question. Somebody's already answered it. So in my own moments of turmoil or challenge or learning lessons, I look to the traditions and look to thousands of years and generations of learning, because in India we have a tradition, and we have a tradition of teacher and taught, which is a spiritual tradition. We call it a guru-disciple relationships. And I've been fortunate enough to study with some of these masters and be a humble disciple to learn. And I saw what great depth of wisdom these traditions hold to us. So I'm not going to give a formula here. I'm just going to refer you to millions of years of collective wisdom. Millions, because we don't know when the humanity started. And since we are collecting our repertoire of knowledge process, whether in written form or spoken form or etheric form, there's always been wisdom available to us. But if you ask my opinion, what is the essence of learning from all these traditions? The essence of learning from all these traditions is being honest to yourself, being sincere to yourself, and give, love, and serve. That's the fastest way to change yourself. Because you stop looking at yourself, you start looking at life.
Well, we've been given these bodies. The planet loans us our bodies in which to live.
Yes.
And that came freely.
Mm-hmm.
And so we...
Yeah. Air comes for free.
Yes, yes.
And most of the things essential to life comes for free. So nature is selflessly giving us. So we rhyme with it. Not that I'm saying that we give up our businesses and our lives, but somehow fit into it. Whatever little baby steps, my teacher used to call it baby steps, that you don't become perfect until you take the first baby step. And first baby step will lead you to the second baby step. So self-transformation happens in baby steps. It doesn't have an overnight enlightenment and somebody keeps hand on my head and my kundalini awakens and I become enlightened. It doesn't work that way, believe me. Even if it is happening that way, there's been some illusion somewhere.
Well, the first step starts with us.
Yes, yes.
Priyesh, Dhanyavad. Thank you so much for coming. It's just so lovely. And we are blessed having you here in this country.
Can I complete it with that mantra?
Certainly.
Om Sahana Vavatu Sahanau Bhunaktu Sahaviryam Karvavahai Tejasvinavadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. May we all be protected together. May we all be guided together. May we all work towards perfection together. And may we all resolve all the negativities by working together and be in peace and light and harmony. Peace.
Om Shanti.
Om Shanti.